Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight is a particular honor for me because, let's face it, my presence on this stage is pretty unlikely. My father was a foreign student, born and raised in a small village in Kenya. He grew up herding goats, went to school in a tin roof shack. His father, my grandfather, was a cook.
Welcome to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. To learn how you can showcase your business or nonprofit, go to our website at TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com for details. Man, we have another great show in store for you today. So sound the alarm. Get on Facebook, Twitter, Foursquare, or Tumblr. Send out emails and text messages. Call your friends and family and tell them to tune in right now to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. And for those of you that are listening via Blog Talk Radio, leave your comments. Click the follow button or follow me on Twitter. And that's at TaylorMade101. I'll be reading your tweets live on the air. And I also have a chat room open. Out there in the chat room, you can leave your comments or ask questions. So whatever your pleasure, chat room, Twitter, Facebook, or just plain old my bell, we want to hear from you. But first, let's take a look at the current events.
Greetings and salutations, everyone. Greetings and salutations. It is, of course, a pleasure to be with you once again. We were out last week. I was actually out preparing for a major event, and thanks to the Lord, we have actually had some success with that event. And so I'm glad to be back here reporting with my co-host, of course, Dajima Hill Cook. We all love her. You know, we talked about last time, we talked about James Garner. And what's interesting, Eric Garner. And since we've been out there, there's new discoveries about the NYPD. So we're going to talk about that. We're also going to talk about year-round school. Should we do it? We take a look at Paul George's injury. And, of course, next week, are you ready for some football? We want to hear from you and your predictions. And, of course, yeah, at the top of the hour, we're going to do Black Acre. Now, if you haven't had an opportunity to go out and look at the Black Acre policy forum, I would encourage you to do so. So we discussed this and much, much more. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. And, of course, we have the executive producer of Current Events and the chief operating officer of Cook Enterprises and the author of Reflections, What I Knew to Be True, I introduce to some and present to others, no other than Dajima Hill Cook. Dajima, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, as always, the pleasure is mine. You know, last time we talked about justice for Eric Garner. This time, I want to talk about justice for Denise Stewart. Now, in case the listening audience haven't heard, in the aftermath of the chokehold death of Eric Garner, has been recently ruled as a homicide. So there's definitely some extra steps taking place right now based on the incident. But some additional officers of the New York Police Department, NYPD, may be in hot water too. Now, this is a report from TheRoot.com, allegedly dragging a half-naked Brooklyn, New York woman into the hall after responding to a domestic disturbance call. The report says a policeman told the news, at least a police spokesman told the news, that the incident is under investigation by Internal Affairs. It occurred about 11:45 p.m., about a couple of weeks ago, and when Denise Stewart, she was 48, was in her apartment in the Brownsville, Brooklyn section of New York City, when officers knocked on her door in response to a call about a domestic disturbance. Officers reportedly heard shouts outside the apartment, the report said. When they knocked, she told them that they had the wrong place and tried to shut the door. Now, police said. Now, Stewart reportedly was dressed only in a towel and underpants, but officers yanked her into the hall, and she was surrounded about 12 officers amid the screams of her family and neighbors. Now, there's a video out on TheRoot.com, and I would encourage you to go out there and look at the video. Here's what I saw. I saw the police arrive at the scene. I saw a individual's perspective videotaping it, where he had an angle pointing at the young lady's apartment, pointing at Denise Stewart's apartment. I saw police in a kind of a confrontation with her, struggling with her, and then moments later, I seen her with no clothes on. Well, quite naturally, they kind of blurred the images out of her her body. But you can hear, just like in the Eric Garner case, people, innocent bystanders, I should say, bystanders, observing the incident, coaching or at least advocating for the victims, in this case, Denise Stewart, in the earlier case, Eric Garner, on their behalf, saying, hey, there's no reason to treat them like that. They haven't done anything, you know, and they kept saying, you know, there was two perspectives, one from an individual downstairs, and then there was a second videotape from upstairs, and the young ladies that were upstairs kept telling the police officers that she had asthma. Be careful. Stop doing her like that. She has asthma. They kept saying it over and over, and the young gentleman says he kept asking the question, where are the female police officers? Why are you treating her like that? Where are the female police officers? You know, and they kept pulling her. And then the final thing I want to say about what I observed is the fact that it was 12 police officers. Now, mind you, this is one young lady, 48 years old, the report says, nearly dressed, as the report says, and she was surrounded by 12 officers, 12 male officers. So just looking at those facts, Jimmy, let me bring you in on the conversation now. You know, does it really, well, let me start with this. What happened to the state of policing around the nation, especially when it comes to dealing with the minority community?
Excuse me. And bear with me as I'm having a head cold. So, here's...
I guess it's better than the chest cold.
Yeah, I think so. here's the deal. I think the unfortunate issue is not that these things are happening all of a sudden. because we've experienced and seen police brutality for years. I mean, you go back to Rodney King, you go back to the Civil Rights Movement, you go back. And so there's been episodes of police brutality. I think what has transpired over the last 5 to 10 years is the availability of actual footage at the time, not just hearsay and not just quote-unquote eyewitness account, but you have actual video footage that cannot be changed because it's right there in front of you. And so I think that's what is the difference in what we see happening, is that more and more of these incidences are being caught on camera, people's cell phones and iPads and things that have recording devices. And so we're catching them at the time that they're happening, not when somebody might decide somebody in, but at that moment. And so because of that, it seems like there has been an increase, but I think it's probably been an increase of our visualization of it. And that I think some of these larger police departments in some of our larger metropolitan areas have long had an issue with being a little heavy-handed with people of color. This isn't a new phenomenon, if you're black or brown, to have the police somewhat harass you. It's just that we now have coverage of it, and it's just not my word against the cop's word. And then the cop will usually come and can get off because he is a man in a uniform and all the stereotypes that go along with me and who I am and what you may perceive me to represent. So, you know, some things never even get a grand jury trial. They never even get the charges are never even filed. But now, because of technology, we're seeing some things up close and personal.
You know, you said something that was really profound, and you do that quite often, I must say. The thing I want to talk about that was profound in your message is about capturing the footage, and specifically with the cell phones and iPads and things of that nature. And it made me recall the footage that was captured back in the Civil Rights Movement when it was shared around the nation of the hoses and the dogs and being turned loose on blacks as they were marching in that campaign. And that had a profound impact on the president, in fact, when he got ready to look at the legislation for the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act. So I think that footage component is key, because just like then, it was happening. People were still getting hosed. They were sitting dogs on them. They were getting hung. But when it's captured on footage, in the footage, and it's shown around the world, and people see, you know, it makes it kind of up close and personal. You know, it's not something written. It's not something that's abstract, but it's more concrete. It has an impact. And I think, you know, your comment about the footage is really being impactful. So the question then I have, what about the use of force, though? The use of force, do you think is excessive?
Well, as we stated a week ago, the for Eric Garner's particular case, the officers used a technique that is no longer legal to use. And so why are they using a technique that they're not even supposed to be using anymore? So yes, that makes it excessive right there, because they're not even following their own rules. So I don't, and you go to the case out in California where they beat down the woman who was crossing traffic on the freeway. I don't know why they had to beat her down so badly. She was in a defenseless position. She wasn't trying to fight back. So, you know, punching her in her face repeatedly as that officer did was excessive force. You know, going after somebody for selling some loose cigarettes is what the case is with Eric Garner. Are you serious? You know, you dispose all of this manpower, use all of this energy, and now you're going to have to pay a whole lot of money to the family because it was ruled a homicide, and now you pour some loose cigarettes that you thought he was selling, because that still hasn't been proven that he was selling some loose cigarettes. Although, you know, they saying that's what he had done in the past, at the time of this incident, that hasn't even come up yet. So you have that, and then you have the cases of those six officers in Philadelphia, I believe, that have all been indicted on corruption charges of false arrest and stealing from the drug dealers' money, almost $500,000, and jewelry and clothes and kidnapping. I would say that's excessive. It's happening everywhere. I mean, it's hard pressed to find a state that hasn't had some case of excessive force by your local law enforcement, who's supposed to be there to serve first. It says serve first. It's the first thing it says is serve and protect. It doesn't say protect and serve. It says serve and protect. So you would think to serve us and be of service with us, to be more community-minded, something that you talk about often, should be the role of our police officers to protect and serve us. And you can protect me by being a part of my community. You can protect me by having a conversation with you. Your badge and your gun and your uniform does not give you jurisdiction over me. I still have a right to question why you stopped me. How I ask you that, I might be cordial, but you need to respond to me. I don't have to do everything you tell me to do, but I haven't done anything wrong. So I think people, and now because of how these situations have been escalating, people are more apt to go on the defense because they want to make sure they protect themselves before they find themselves on the other side of something.
That's the
unfortunate part.
Yeah, absolutely. That reminds me of almost being like in a hostile environment. When you mention about as we have on this radio show many times about the relationship that needs to take place between the community and the officers that protect the community. It's hard for you to come in and just all of a sudden do these things without having some type of relationship with me. Even if it's tangential, doesn't mean you have to know me directly, but you can know me indirectly. It shouldn't be the first time that I see you when something happens. I should see you in the good times and in the bad times. So, I mean, that's kind of my best case scenario. But even in the worst case, it shouldn't be a hostile relationship just the first time I see you. Now, granted, we all know that the police face a lot of danger. We know there's a lot of criminal people out there. But every person they come in contact with, I don't think, in my opinion, that it doesn't have to be automatically hostile. It should be, quite naturally, the police officer has to be on the defensive. He needs to be checking out the situation because he don't need to be caught off guard or with his pants down, per se. But at the same time, the situation that we refer to, the man, cigarettes, this is not a drug dealer. This is not somebody that had somebody hostage or at gunpoint. He was just standing outside Eric Garner. The young lady was in her towel, in her own domain. They pulled her outside, and 12 of them, and then we're talking about the young lady on the highway, which they were just beating. I mean, he was just beating her over and over and over again, These acts of violence make the environment hostile. So now, after seeing this so many times, I, as you said, I am now on the defensive when I'm faced with a cop. It's almost, if he stopped me, we got to go to war. I haven't done anything wrong, but now I don't know what position to be in, because obviously you don't have to be doing anything to get hemmed up. So it's a bad situation for the community and the policemen. So we need to be taking steps towards mending that relationship. And so that begs the question, was NWA prophets when they made the song F the Police? I mean, they had a lot of components in their lyrics, long, long time ago. So were they prophets,
Well, I think, what we have to be careful is that we don't lump them all into one. As you stated, there are some good officers out on the streets that take their job seriously, but also take the lives of the community that they protect and serve seriously as well. I think the other thing, though, is that when we find the ones that are of the bad seeds, they need to be dealt with. And this code of blue and and not telling on people and you know, keeping bad people around that should no longer be around. And some should have never been hired in the beginning, but because of the danger nature of it, you know, I don't think there's a waiting list of people to become police officers. It might be, I don't know, but I'm just thinking, you know, because the things that you have to do to become, you know, there's a lot that goes into it, and I hope that the mental health of these officers is checked on a regular basis and not just at the point of entry. I know they put you through a battery of tests at the beginning, but I think some things need to be done on an annual basis to see if you've had some life-changing event that has changed your perspective on what you do from how you started to where you are now. And so, as I stated, careful not to lump them all into one category, because we know there are, you know, good officers out there, but we also have to be aware of the fact that the bad ones that are out there is going to make it difficult for the good ones, because I'm going to be now, I don't know who's good or bad, because this is just what I'm seeing, you know. And so the bad stories, as in any situation, see more than the good, you know. And so when you have states that have passed laws around, you know, with the case, I think this was in Georgia, where they issue a warrant and it's a no-knock warrant, so they don't have to knock, and then come to find that they're knocking on the wrong door. They throw tear gas in the house. It lands in the baby's crib. The baby's face is burned. I mean, and they at the wrong daggum house. And so, you know, those types of things. And so now you have a child scarred for life, literally, because of what the police did without considering where they was knocking at. Although there was baby stuff out front, there was, you know, a playpen on the porch. So everything about it told them there's the possibility of a child in here. We might want to do this one a little different. But they didn't think about that. And so because of that, you know, they're going to have to pay for that and that child and how that family has to deal with that grief and the years of suffering that child will have to endure. And so there has to be a balance. And I don't know what that is, but I know how we're going right now is not right. And as diligent as they go after cop killers and people when you watch all these cop shows, which I watch probably too many, but when you watch all these cop shows and they are out there and they are really to find the cop killer and everybody band together, we need to have that same banding together as a community when cops go out and do things against us. And so that's not to say that we go hunt them down and do all that, but we are vigilant in terms of how we report what we see and how we are just aware of what's happening in our own neighborhoods and our own communities, so that when they come in, we can provide them with the information in which they're looking for. I mean, everybody know what a drug man is. Everybody know what a dope man is. Everybody know the house. So I don't even know why we play like we don't know. You know which house on the block is the house that's doing some dirt. So instead of having them knocking on doors unnecessarily, you know, do your due diligence to keep your neighborhood safe. So then that innocent child don't have to be killed or burned or maimed unnecessarily.
You know, that goes back, though, to the point that when police officers are involved in the neighborhood or involved in the community or providing community service, going out and visiting, checking the welfare of people, they know the people who they're dealing with, you know? And you can pick up on something if it's wrong. You know, I often say when I go home sometimes, me and my friends, we have conversations, and people, sometimes they won't invite me out to places because they know I don't do those type of things, right? So we don't want Cook to come because, you know, he doesn't get down like that. So they won't invite me. So, you know, when I show up in a place, even if the thing's around, they try to remove those things, right? So at the same time, when police officers are around, they can sense when something is not right. So as opposed to going to a place where a child is, you know that person lives there. You know there's no activity there. Or you have a high probability of it not happening in that particular place. But if you don't hang out in the neighborhood for the good times, if you don't build relationships, be involved in the community, attend the meetings, things of that nature, to see what's going on in the community, then you don't understand. And then you make the mistake, like you mentioned, about the baby being burned and now costing the baby's future, the family's future, because they have to support the baby. You know, and, you know, no amount of money can be able to replace the life or the issues that baby will have from that point forward. And so it's better when you know the people you're working with. And it just is very disheartening for me to hear, you know, these events that continue to take place when they can be prevented in a lot of different ways. And you mentioned something about a battery of tests that they take on the entry. And you also mentioned the fact that, you know, what happens after they've been in the force for a while, they may have had some life significant emotional event or some life-changing event that caused their perspective to change. So the question then is this a matter of training for the police department, or is this a community issue, or is this a policy issue?
It's all of the above. I think it's all of the above. I don't think you do one without having an impact on the other. I think the community has a part, but I also know that the department itself has a role to play in ensuring that those officers that are protecting and serving us in the community are trained appropriately and consistently and annually. I mean, there's some things that we all have to go through. If you're in that line of work, you got to keep certain certifications up, your CPR and first aid and those sorts of things, your techniques, your weapons training. I mean, just like they are hard on weapons training, they need to be hard on conflict resolution and conflict management and intervening in hostile situations and how to – I'm not saying you need to be a therapist for a police officer, but you need to know how to talk to people. And you need to know how to get what you want out of that situation, because you know, grandma and them used to always say it's easy, you know, to get flies, you know, milk with honey, or somebody flies with honey or something. I don't know, but it's easy to get somebody with something sweet and something sour. How about that? And so because of that, if over the time, you know, you become stale to what you're doing and stagnant in your role, then you it becomes just routine for you. And so if on an annual basis or every other year they go through a battery of tests, and I know they have to do it after they shoot somebody, they go through, you know, they have to go check in with the little counselor people and all that, but I think it should also be just intermittent so that, you know, it's not attached to an event, so to speak. It's just a part of the process, and it very well may be, I don't know. It's not or it's and. It's training and it's community and it's policy. You take a look at when our police officers violate their own rules, their own policies, what should happen? If you are an employee of a company and you blatantly violate, there's some rules as a worker that works in child services, youth, and juvenile justice, that if I violate, it's an automatic suspension. Whether or not, I can't come back to work until this is resolved. Initially, I'm on leave with pay, pending an investigation. So that means I'm not even in the building. So this officer who, and these officers that did the chokehold should have immediately been suspended, even if it was with pay, but they should not still be in that precinct. But they were given death duty, and I don't think that's right. They should have been moved out and pending the investigation, and once the investigation is complete, then we find out what we can do. And there are some infractions that are termination. I don't have to, that's, it's automatic. And you know, you violate a child, you steal, you come to work intoxicated, those sorts of things, you falsify documents and records, those are automatic grounds of termination. So I'm not sure now that we got the word from the coroner that this is a homicide, that this man was killed. I need to know if the officers are still on duty, why, and at what point are they going to do their investigation and relieve them of their duty? Because that's what needs to happen,
you know,
in that particular case. So it's not an or, it's an and, an and, and an and.
You know, what's interesting is that Reverend Al Sharpton, who is always leading on these issues, and people can say what they want to about him, but he has been consistent. He's been in the fight. He's been on the front lines. And you have to admire someone that is down for the cause and really get results. I mean, he's just not talk. He's about walking the walk as well. And speaking of walking the walk, he has been really vocal on the issue of James Garner in lieu of the recent events. In fact, over the weekend, he said the following, addressing Mayor Bellagio of New York. He said, if Dante wasn't your son, he'd be a candidate for a chokehold. And we've got to deal with that reality. And for those of you that may not know, Mayor Bellagio has a son who's of mixed race and has an afro and been out out on TV a lot, you know, doing commercials for different things. But for the most part, he's saying that if Dante wasn't your son, he'd be a candidate for a chokehold. I mean, he's a young black man, and if people didn't know him to be your son, he'd get the business too. What do you think about Reverend Al Sharpton's statement, and how much validity do you believe that could be the case?
I agree with that 100%. I mean, and that was something that even was talked about during when de Blasio was running for mayor of New York City, and the use, you know, using of his son in different capacities to show what his plight was going to be towards the African-American community, especially around the whole stop and frisk. And I believe even then, Reverend Al made statements that, you know, your son himself could be stopped. And I believe there was a case in which his son was stopped. And so there's a lot of truth to that. And there's a lot of validity to the fact that some of us, for whatever reason, are profiled and are followed around or, you know, stopped or questioned more often than others. And to say that it has nothing to do with race is false. And to say that it's all about race, I don't know if that's, you know, I can't say it's all on either side, but we know that race has a factor. And we cannot act as if it doesn't. And so I agree with Reverend Al, you know, and I hope that the mayor, you know, this is his first true test of what he's going to do with his police department, who tends to be a brute and who tends to run their own however they want to do it. And so he has to get them in line and get with that police commissioner. And if some changes need to be made in the city of New York's police department, then he needs to be the one to make those changes. And they have to be things that we can see right away. And this case with this young man, with that officer or those officers that were involved, this is where he's going to earn his stripes. He's either going to sink or swim on this one. And everybody is watching to see because of what he ran on. Everybody's watching to see how he's going to respond. And this is the beginning, because what happens there, as people are watching there, they're watching what's happening in California with those highway patrol. They're watching what's happening down in Georgia with that family. And even the case where the guy was the informant down in Florida, and they end up getting killed. And then you have the police officers in Florida that were members of the KKK. I mean, people are watching. And people are paying attention, and you know, at some point, the pot is going to boil over, and what we don't want is for riots to break out across this country, because we know we have more weapons on the streets now than we did back in the '60s, and yes, it would just be bloodshed on both sides. It wouldn't be pretty on either side. So we don't want the pot to boil over.
That's a true statement. All right, it's time for a quick break. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Be back in a moment.
You are listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. coming to you live from Dallas, Texas. My mom and dad will be right back after these messages.
Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Jima, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com. and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jamal. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy. And I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend. And, of course, my East Boone.
Need a new website? Haven't figured out your social media strategy? Are you finally ready to tweet, post, or blog? Well, look no further. Go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. We are the number one resource for small businesses and nonprofits. We're a full-service, interactive consulting firm specializing in social media marketing, web design, technology workshops, as well as leadership and management training. So go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. Google me.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. I want to shift now to a question that I posed several weeks ago, and I want to kind of have a quick discussion about it. And it won't be the first time that we cover this particular topic, but I want to start introducing it now as we begin the school year. And that question simply is about year-round schools. What are the benefits and what are the drawbacks? Now, there are several schools of thoughts on this, but before we get into any of the details, administrative or technical, if you will, I just want to have a real brief conversation about it. And, Jim, I want to kind of get your input. You know, is this a good thing, or is there drawbacks to this? What are your thoughts about year-round school?
Well, I think it's a good thing. just on a layman's perspective, not speaking from an educator's perspective, I think times that we're in right now, it would do us well to make sure our kids are learning what they need to learn, and that we would do well to provide them with enough opportunities to do so. And I think having what they call a year-round school has its benefit in terms of keeping the kids' minds active and keeping them engaged in something. I'm sure the drawbacks is from the administrative side and parental side is the time and not necessarily having those extended breaks and things of that nature. But all of those things can be planned around, however that school year goes. So I don't think it's a bad idea. So I'm kind of for it, actually. I would like to know, I don't know if, I know we have a couple back home in Kansas. As a matter of fact, they started a new program, and I meant to get that information from my mom, but they have something that they're starting at one of the new, actually my old middle school, Northwest Middle School. They actually started school 2 weeks before everybody else did, and they started this past Friday, and school doesn't start for everybody else for 2.5 weeks from now. So that in itself, you know, somewhere, you know, they're trying out something new, and that's a school right there in the community, in the hood, so to speak, neighborhood school, and so it's giving those kids a leg up, and I think that's a good idea. Anytime you get a leg up, that's a good idea.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. You know, the very thought of sending kids to school year-round, there's an article that talks about this particular concept. And as you mentioned, it makes parents cringe, of course. But they balk at the idea of kids attending school with no summer break. The question, the value of a continuous school year interspersed with several short breaks with the schedule is definitely not what the majority of us grew up with. So it's because it's unfamiliar territory, and it seems like they're not getting breaks. It seems like the kids are getting fatigued throughout the year. This is why some of the arguments that the parents are having for not doing it. Now, so some of the opposing arguments saying that rather than give kids less time off, a year-round schedule offers the same 100 days of schooling as a traditional calendar created long ago. But so let me first define what the literature says about year-round schooling. And let's take that for a second. And let's talk about the time, or at least the definition as put forth by Scholastic.com. Kids in year-round schools attend classes from anywhere from 6 to 9 weeks in a row, broken up by 2 to 4 week vacations. That says some educators keep the learning process ongoing with minimal disruption. A Duke University study even suggested kids attending year-round schools are at a slight advantage because they don't forget what they learn during the summer break. Now, it's a very well-known research issue of kids lose a lot of the traction that they gain throughout the year if they don't maintain some level of engagement or involvement in reading and math over the summer. They lose some of that. Now, schools in fast-growing areas transition to year-round schedules as a way to ease overcrowding. When that occurs, kids are placed on multi-tracks and alternative tracking in and out of school, a process that keeps the building in constant use. So rather than having an idle building burning up, you know, just, you know, idle energy, they're saying, let's use the building continuously by giving these kids 6 to 9 weeks of education in a row, then take a 2 week break, and then back to that. So it amounts to about the same amount of time in school. It just it closes the gap on when they leave school and they come back. So based on that definition of year-round schooling, Jima, what do you think would prevent a system from adopting that as a model?
Cost. That's the only thing. They'll come up with a reason as to why it would cost too much to run those schools during either the hotter months or the colder months, depending on where you live. They'll make it be about a budgetary issue as opposed to what's in the best interest of the students and what's in the best interest of that community. We know that, based on our own research we've done, that over that summer break, kids lose a percentage or 2 or 3 points in their reading scores and their math scores over the summer because they're not doing it. And so if you keep that going over those months, then they're already, they're ready, they're paired, and they stay ready and they stay prepared, so that first 6 weeks of the school year or 3 weeks of school when you get back in August, you're not trying to catch up with what they lost from June. And so you spend a little lot of time catching up and trying to get them ready to take a test in October so that, you know, they pass this test that they have to take and they meet all these other things. And so if they're there already, we're not necessarily having to play catch up. But I think the reason why it'll come down to money. It'll come down to dollars. And we know that you know, we spend way more to incarcerate than we do to educate. And so if we were to spend the same amount educating our students, then we wouldn't have to spend that much to incarcerate them because they wouldn't be getting in trouble.
You know, that when you talk about the total cost of education with respect to, you know, all the issues that you mentioned, it seems like we are paying more when we don't make that initial investment. You know, even I'm not even talking about, you know, the middle school years or high school years. I'm talking about the pre-K and even before that, even investing in prenatal care and, you know, and investing in preparing kids so when they hit the first grade, they're really ready. And, you know, by the time they hit middle school, if they've been in a pattern, even if they don't adopt it at all levels, let's say if they adopt this model at just the elementary levels, right, where they keep these kids and have them build that foundation early with a pre-K model and then with a kindergarten model and then maybe a year-round school model at the elementary levels, when you get into middle school, then maybe you can kind of slack off because they do it in some instances in high school. I remember that I had so many credits as a high school senior that I didn't really have to go to school too hard because I had took all 4 years of math. I took algebra, geometry, calculus, pre-calculus, trigonometry, all of those math courses. And, you know, I had, you know, years of English. So by the time I got to be a senior, those two classes I only had to take it, and I was good. I had a DECA where I could go and take off and go to work after the afternoon. But I had done my due diligence in the early years, freshman, sophomore, and junior year, where I took all the courses that I needed. And then by the time I got to my senior year, I took, English and then, you know, an advanced math course, and that was it. And so I didn't really have to do anything else.
And I think the other thing, if not year round, then we have extended day. I mean, you know, I haven't figured out the schedule yet, and it could just be me. But like, you know, our son's 8 o'clock and he's out at 3:10, and yet there's some high school kids who bus picks him up at 8 o'clock, which means they school ain't started yet, and yet they are out before he gets out of school at 3:10. So that's confusing to me that their day is short. I don't know. It seems to be shorter than what an elementary school's day is, and yet that age group should be more concentrated on making sure that they are prepared for life after high school. That's number one. The second thing is, if we're going to talk about either extended days or year-round school, I think you're right in terms of making sure that the curriculum is meeting the needs of where the kids are. So you have these wonderful things. And what I love about Garland ISD is the fact that it does have magnet schools, and it has gifted and talented schools that's designed for that population. But they also have the ability, if you don't want your child to be isolated or to go to that type of school, that they have curriculum in other schools to meet the needs of your child. My thing is, you know, I went to a college preparatory high school that when I went, it started in the 8th grade and went all the way up to the 12th grade. You could only come in the 8th grade back when I was going there. I think now it's more open. But when I was going there, you could only come in 8th grade. And that built your foundation. And there were so many things that we had to do, as you mentioned, in terms of our foreign languages, in terms of our math. And it was funny because I was on Facebook, and we were talking about back in the day when they implemented these math objectives. And you had to pass all of these math objectives before you could graduate, so to speak. And most of us that I know passed most of them, you know, when we first took the test in the 6th grade, I think. And it was actually based on those 6th grade test scores as to whether or not you got an invite to go to the Sumner Academy. And so we were talking about, you know, and I often say the last set I had to pass was fractions, and I'm not sure what the thing is I had with fractions, but I don't think I passed my fractions until, like, the 7th or 8th grade, which was retarded. Well, I shouldn't say that. It was crazy for me to have waited. I don't know what it was, but the environment that I was in from grade school to middle school to high school nurtured all of that. And so it was, if your environment is going to nurture learning, then whether you are year-round or extended day, we have to just make sure we're giving the kids the tools they need to be successful. And that's where I have a problem with our education system now. I do not feel that in our totality of how we educate our children, that we are actually giving them the tools they need to be successful. And how we fix that there's more than one way to fix that. It could be extended day. It could be year-round. It could be more magnet schools. It could be more charter schools. It could be investing more in our public schools. It's not, this is another one of those that is not a or, it's an and so we try out different things until we get the right formula. I mean, when they invented Coke, they didn't stop Coca-Cola. They didn't stop with the first tasting. And after it didn't taste like nothing, they put it down. They kept going. They kept trying different ways until they got it right. And when they got it right, that's the real thing. And that's been their slogan ever since. And so we can't try one thing educationally and then stop because it doesn't work or it doesn't meet our needs or we don't feel whatever we want to feel about it. We've got to keep trying until we get this thing right. And for those of us that came up through the public school system, and for those of us that know a little bit about this whole process, you know, we've got to do better at informing others about it. We've got to say, well, what do we get as children growing up in the project, going to public school? What do we get?
Yeah, but people have this I got mine, you get yours mentality. Because if that was the case, then more people would be involved in their children's. And even if it's not their children, because the people that took care of us back then were not our parents all the time. And it was our neighbors, the people in our school system. Our counselors were involved in our lives. So it was really a community effort. And, you know, you talk about it takes a village. It really took a village. And so I don't know where the village people went. I mean, I think they've all left town. And the mentality that we have about I got mine, you get yours, I think that is more prevalent in our society today than it was a few generations ago.
Yeah, that's for sure. That is for sure. And therein lies the problem right there. So, I mean, you know, it's the chicken or the egg, what you deal with first.
Yep. All right, it's time for another break. And on the other side of the break, of course, we're going to do our Black Acre segment. We're going to do our Black Acre segment at the top of the hour. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Be back in a moment.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Gema, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for a discounted book for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Current Events with Patrick Cook is joining the fight with First Lady Michelle Obama to help feed hungry children and stop childhood obesity. During the school year, many children receive free and reduced price breakfast and lunch as a result of the school breakfast and national school lunch programs. However, when the last bell sounds, marking the end of the school year, for many, it marks the beginning of hunger that will plague them throughout the summer. Here at Current Events, we're going to fill that nutrition gap and make sure children can get the nutritious meals they need. To learn how you can help with this worthy cause, go to TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free. That's TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy. And I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend. And of course, my East Bloom friend.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Current Events with Patrick Cook. Patrick Cook.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Heavy fighting in Gaza today after an Israeli airstrike near a UN school serving as a shelter killed at least 10 Palestinians. The U.S. says it's appalled by what it calls the disgraceful shelling of that school, which was sheltering around 3,000 people displaced by the fighting. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki says Israel has to do more to meet its own standards to avoid civilian casualties. And UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is also condemning the incident, calling it a moral outrage and a criminal act. Meanwhile, thousands of Israelis today attended the funeral of an Israeli soldier killed in an attack in Gaza on Friday. Initially, Israel believed militants had taken him captive, as Daniel Estrin reports.
The killed soldier's father recited the Jewish mourner's prayer, and those gathered replied, Amen, at the funeral of 2nd Lieutenant Hadar Golden. At first, Israel feared Golden was taken captive in Gaza, and the soldier's family had demanded that Israeli forces remain in Gaza until the soldier was retrieved. Later, Israel announced that evidence was found he was killed. His funeral came as Israeli media reported that Israeli troops would soon be pulling out of Gaza, but Israel continued attacks today, and militants continued to fire rockets at Israel. Annie Szymanski, who attended the funeral, said it did not feel like the conflict was winding down.
Standing here, my husband just sent me a text that he was in Tel Shomer Hospital and there was an explosion right over his head. That doesn't feel like an end of a war.
Two other Israeli soldiers killed in Friday's attack were also buried. For NPR News, I'm Daniel Estrin at the Israeli Military Cemetery in Kfar Saba.
Meanwhile, Israel is deploying many of its troops away from the Gaza Strip today. The death toll from a strong earthquake in southwest China today is rising. At least 360 people were killed in the magnitude 6.1 quake. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports from Shanghai.
The earthquake struck late afternoon local time near Jiaotong City, according to China Radio International. A city resident told the New China News Service that her neighbor's two-story home had collapsed. She also said the streets looked like a, quote, battlefield after bombardment. Electricity was cut and mobile phone calls were difficult. The epicenter of the quake was Longtoshan Township, where officials reported many collapsed buildings. The mountainous area is prone to earthquakes. 2 years ago, more than 80 people died and more than 800 were injured when a 5.7 magnitude quake struck the area. Frank Lightfoot, NPR News, Shanghai.
President Obama will make a decision by the end of the summer on how to use his authority to address the border crisis with the tens of thousands of immigrants in the U.S. illegally. Dan Pfeiffer told ABC's This Week the president is waiting for recommendations from Attorney General Eric Holder and also Homeland Secretary Jay Johnson. But Pfeiffer says any actions Obama takes would be within the confines of the law. That's after Congress failed to act before heading out for a 5-week summer recess. This is NPR. In northern Iraq, the extremist group, the Islamic State, has seized two towns and three small oil fields, killing at least 14 Kurdish soldiers. NPR's Allison Mews reports the militants are closing in on a border crossing.
Reinforcements are headed to the towns of Sinjar and Zumar, where clashes are raging between Iraqi Kurdish soldiers called Peshmerga and the Islamic State. The UN says 200,000 people have fled, most from the minority Yazidi community. The Peshmerga from Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdish region are also defending the Rabia Post, the only one of three border crossings with Syria not held by the Islamic State. One Peshmerga commander says he's cooperating with the Kurdish militiamen on the Syrian side to secure the crossing, and he's expecting more weapons to arrive shortly. The Kurdish soldiers have filled a vacuum left by the National Iraqi Army, which fled from the Islamic State assault in June. Since then, the Kurds have taken control of much previously disputed territory. Allison Mews, NPR News, Beirut.
An American doctor brought back to the U.S. yesterday to be treated for the Ebola virus is said to be improving. Dr. Kemp Brantley was infected in Africa while working with an aid group. CDC Director Dr. Tom Frieden says they hope Brantley continues to improve. He told CBS's Face the Nation the spread of Ebola can be stopped, but he says it's not easy.
We can stop it from spreading in hospitals, and we can stop it in Africa, where is really the source of the epidemic and where we're surging our response, so that we can control it there.
Brantley was brought to Emory University Hospital in Atlanta yesterday. He actually walked from the ambulance into the hospital wearing protective gear. This is now the largest Ebola outbreak. 700 people have died in three West African countries. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. You know, we're at the top of the hour, and just like every week when we come on, we talk about our Black Acre blog segment. Today, we're going to be discussing a topic that's near and dear to my heart, and it is because it is talking about reconciling faith. In particular, the blog stated, reconciling faith and the challenges facing the Black church. And so I'm going to make an attempt to kind of discuss the blog a little bit here, and then we're going to have Leo Baron Hicks join us here momentarily discuss it. So I want you all to get ready for our Black Acre Policy Forum, and here it goes.
It's time for Black Acre Policy Forum, a progressive think tank founded by Leo Baron Hicks, a place where a new dialogue concerning public policy can find innovative strategies and bold solutions. Welcome to Black Acre Policy Forum.
I'm able to see clear the right, cause Louis H. Slattimore improved the light, and J.A. Burr invented the lawnmower. Let me expand the mind of all you young soldiers. Sarah Boone invented the...
Particular blog has kind of sparked quite a few comments, and after I go through a few of the segments of the blog, we want to talk a little bit about the comments as well. And Jimmy, we're going to get your input on it too. It is entitled Reconciling Faith and the Challenges Facing the Black Church. Now, you can go out and visit the blog at blackacrepolicyforum.org. That's BLACKACRE, Black Acre Policy Forum, all one word, .org. And quite naturally, when you get out there, you'll see an area where you can click on the blogs, and you can see all of the blogs that are out there, blog posts that are out there. Reconciling Faith and the Challenges Facing the Black Church. Now, it reads, I have a confession to make. When it comes to faith and religion, I am deeply conflicted. Like many middle-aged African Americans, I come from a faith-based background. Those who raised me were and still are deeply religious. My youth as an altar boy in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, sitting on the side of the minister as he delivered his sermon and extinguishing the candles at the end of the service has forever marked me. Try as I might, I cannot ignore my heritage. In addition, 90% of the people I interact with, including my best friends, are people of faith. And as I near my own mortality, I find myself praying all the time with increasing frequency. In the last year, I have implored, "Dear Father, please help your son," on more than one occasion. Still, I am torn. Something appears to be fundamentally wrong with at least some of our faith-based institutions. So bear with me as I try to sort this out. First, we grow increasingly concerned about the corporations, the capitalization of the church, many of which resemble less houses of worship than for-profit business. With a business model of company growth and expansion of the church's sphere of influence, they come replete with a chief executive officer, a chief financial officer, marketing departments, quality control functions, phone banks, investment portfolios, advertising budgets, and customer service divisions. The only difference between many a church and many a business is that where a manufacturer produces widgets, churches sell religion. This is especially true of the mega churches, as well as the small and medium-sized institutions who wish to mimic them. We are all so apprehensive about the priorities of the church. We know that no person or institution is perfect. We all fall short of God's grace, none more so than I. Nonetheless, many a congregation lavish untold wealth and attention on buildings, equipment, and things rather than the people they serve. And some church services are nothing short of Hollywood, all show and glitz. Essentially social clubs, they are long on entertainment and short on salvation. Other congregations are so concerned about their hereafter as to be of no earthly good. Yes, preserving church assets is important, and saving souls is critical, but saving a life and preserving a family, a neighborhood, and a community are equally significant. By one estimate, there are 100,000 predominantly black churches in America. We believe this to be a conservative estimate. In the most densely populated African-American communities, it is not uncommon to find as many as 3 churches per block. Poverty, unemployment, and homelessness, black-on-black crime, teenage single parenthood, dysfunctional families, and cultural decline threatening our very existence. Yet, for all of this, religion, the church, has been largely ineffective in arresting these problems. Please note, this is not a question of effort or input. It is instead a matter of impact and outcomes. And while we welcome the effort, positive results have yet to be achieved. In fact, our situation worsens with each day passing. Nor can we ignore the reality of greed and exploitation. The Atlanta Black Star recently revealed that several pastors are making 200 times more than the people they serve. One pastor had a net worth of $27 million, while the community he served has an average income of only $29,000. As Jeremy Camara, the director of the documentary Contradiction, observed, while looking at the financial numbers, it is easy to believe that some preachers are using religion for monetary gain. Hypocrisy is easily the moral cancer of any faith. Hence, church leaders cannot say one thing and do another. They cannot request our meager resources in the form of tithes and labor while possessed of wealth and privilege gained by their positions in the church. They cannot demand our humility, our unqualified fidelity, while offering none of their own. church members cannot profess kindness and then turn kindless at the drop of a hat. We have all experienced the hot mess that exists in some churches. We have all seen one of the devout cut someone to shreds as effectively yet nonchalantly as a butcher works at ham. In short, we hear what you say, but see what you do. We question no one's faith, nor is the purpose to excoriate the church. There are, however, two essential questions we must pose. First, in addition to saving souls, is the church also morally obligated to offer practical solutions to the social problems that plague us? And second, is the church further obligated to lead not by words but by example? There are yet additional reasons for this analysis. From a social perspective, our community is at a historic crossroads. Seldom has there been a greater need for constructive behavior and ethical clarity. Far too many are lost, alienated, and alone. They search not for the heavy hand of fire and brimstone, but for the gentle touch of love and compassion. If they cannot find this love, this grace, this compassion at home, they will look to the streets. The churches is one of the few valuable institutions remaining to us. Thus, the church cannot and must not fail. And on a personal level, I need faith. I need to believe that there is a greater purpose to this thing called life, that there is a higher power that is beneficent and caring, that is connected to me and connects to me all. I need to know that the divine is with me. If God has a plan for me, then I will follow his will. But I would appreciate the armor, the shield, and the cover of faith to see me through. Could I make it without some form of faith? Yes, I could. However, as the journey of life is made more difficult without it, I choose to believe. So regardless of my doubts and hesitations, I will probably partner with the church, assuming, of course, I can find one that will take me, unrepentant heathen that I am. Leo Baron Hicks, founder and CEO of Black Policy Forum. Leo, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot. How are you, Mr. Cook?
Absolutely wonderful. Man, it is great to have you with us once again. And I must say, another magnificent piece of work. Well done, and as you know, well done.
Well, thank you so much. You know, when you were reading it, it was hard to believe that I wrote it. You know, I was literally sitting here. Did I write that?
Yes, you did.
But I guess I did.
and great as it was. And it's obvious to me that you approach this thing from a personal perspective, but it is oddly enough, it shares many of our views. So, how did you come how did you come for this piece of work? How did this work come to be?
Well, you know, I've been having some concerns and challenges with faith for a long time. You know, because quite frankly, I see people who go to church every day, but they are some of the most hateful people I have ever seen in my life.
Isn't there?
And I, you know, and I see the problems that beset African Americans and all of the churches that we belong to, yet they don't seem to be making any difference in some of the real problems we're facing. And I guess the third reason is this, though, quite frankly. First, like the post said, I could make it without faith, but life is so difficult that it helps me to get through one day to the other. And secondly, if I'm going to do this thing called Black Acre, I probably need all the help I can get.
I definitely understand. So, Jima, let me get you to weigh in here. You know, I often tell people that, you know, I was at a crossroads in my life, and I asked God specifically for a woman of faith. It didn't matter to me whether or not she had a degree. It didn't matter or not whether she was had a good financial background. It didn't matter to me whether she was, you know, gorgeous. It just so happened, because I looked for a woman of faith, I got all of those things along with that in you. And so because you're a woman of faith, I know you understand this line of thinking, this line of that Leo has presented here. So I want to kind of get you your thoughts on this blog post and if you have any questions for Leo.
Well, I think what we have to remember when we talk about faith is that is personal. And when you're talking about your relationship with God, it's personal. And as much as we look at people who go to church, are they living Christ-like? That's the difference. Have they really embraced the full teachings of Christ, not the full teachings of their pastor or their priest or their bishop, but do they spend time studying the Word and allowing that scripture to manifest itself in their lives, that it shows out in what they're doing? And so it's personal. Faith is personal. It can't be quantified by what somebody else is doing or how somebody else's life is. It's all about what you need. And it's interesting with Leo, because we often talk about personal responsibility. And it's the same thing in our walk of faith. It's a personal responsibility in how we choose to live our lives. You made the statement that, you know, people that go to church every day, and some of them can be so hateful, some of the most hateful people you know. They make that decision every day to be just that hateful, just like they make that decision to go and rob that bank or shoot some people. It's still a decision that we make. And God doesn't force himself on us. He gives us free will to choose whether or not we want to be in fellowship with him and be in his presence. And so you can do that numerous ways. You can do it by yourself, driving in your car, assembling with other believers in a building called a church, a mosque, a temple, whatever. But it's a personal choice. And faith is a personal thing that based on who you are and where you are in your life depends on your level of faith, because there's degrees to it. You know, some people have faith that they're going to wake up in the morning, and they do. Some people have faith that you know, they're going to get that job they've been looking for. And so if the call doesn't come tomorrow, they believe it's going to come, and they believe it's going to come. And when it finally comes, they exercise that faith because they kept believing. They didn't give up. And so that, you know, so when you're talking about it, it's a personal thing, and it's going to look different for everybody, as is all of our relationship with Christ, God, Jehovah, whoever you call him. For me, it's Jesus and God. It looks different. How I serve and worship is different from how my husband serves and worships. But he does serve and he does worship, and that's more important to me than the how. The fact that he does is what keeps us connected, not that he's not doing it like me, because, you know, everybody can't do it like me. I probably don't want everybody to do it like me. So it's a personal thing.
So I'm glad you mentioned that, because, you know, I expressed the same sentiments a while back as well, because I do believe it is a personal relationship. The foundation is the Bible, you know, for my faith. And the fact that, you know, I get in and I study differently than others. You know, I don't just go to hear the preacher give the message, because to me that is icing on the cake. It's not the cake. You know, so it takes me, you know, and I remember hearing one person talk about the Bible was written by Shakespeare. I remember that, you know, I try to discern who King James was, and why did it have to be a King James version. So, you know, that stuff I can't get from the church. That stuff I have to get out and do my own due diligence, do my own studying, and come to a relationship and understanding for myself. And I love the fact that I have a really, really good relationship with the Lord. I know he speaks to me in ways that, you know, I couldn't explain, because of the fact that it's nothing that I could show you to be able to explain it, because it's just so overwhelming at times. And so I think this issue of faith, Leo, is a very good one, and I think it's a normal one that people have as they begin to seek God's face, as they become as they become more involved and more learned in the word and into the practices of Jesus. Because, you know, every time you see a person walking around the street with a gold chain on, don't mean they're a rapper or don't mean they're, you know, that they're rich. They, you know, just the same thing when it goes to you see a person walking around with the Bible, don't mean that they follow Christ holistically. So, you know, don't take a lot of stock into the people that actually talk about the word. You have to take a lot of stock in the people that actually perform and acting it out. So it really begs the question, though, the larger question I think you were also addressing was about the church and about their impact on the community, which seems to be diminishing over time. Now, I haven't looked at any of the statistics, but when you look at the fact that the civil rights movement, or you look at the fact that the voting rights movement, you know, it seems like it was rooted in the church, and now we have similar social issues, gun control, environment. It seems like the church is not having the same type of impact. So, Leo, is that where you were going in the talking about the church piece?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I try to stay away from questions of faith because you believe as you believe. And it doesn't matter if I agree with you or don't agree with you. I mean, if it's your faith, it's your faith. And I note for the record, if faith is a personal relationship with God, then the church really doesn't matter. The religion doesn't matter. Or the particular Bible doesn't matter. What you call your God really doesn't matter. If it truly is a personal relationship, a subjective relationship that depends upon the person, if that's the case, then it does call into question particular religions. But I really wrote the piece, though, to address the larger question. What is the responsibility of the church to the community as opposed to what is the responsibility of the individual to the church? And I'm not at all persuaded that the church is living up to its responsibility to the community.
Yeah, and I think I can
agree with that.
Yeah, I think that's backed by a lot of evidence. When you talk about the disparity in income, for example, I mean, if you're making $27 million, it seems like you should be able to flow that down in some ways to a community that even if it's just one block at a time, you know, I'm going to get to these other blocks, but if I'm making that kind of income, I should be able to create jobs. I should be able to help redistribute some education or be able to do something to have an impact on that community. But yet, there seems like the community is poor and poor, but the pastors are getting richer and richer. And so that's the same corporate model as you kind of alluded to in the piece.
Exactly.
But in challenging that thought process, and I'm not necessarily challenging it, but so let's say you do have a church that's doing some of those things. They have a school. They have businesses and things of that nature, and they employ their people. And some of their members work for the church, and some of them live in that community. But we all know that there still be those in the community who still won't take responsibility for themselves to go out and learn something where they themselves can be an asset. So if I have the school here, and yet, you know, you don't have enough in you to get your child over here to the school, then you want me to come wake them up for you? I mean, I still think, from what Leo has mentioned before, around that personal responsibility piece, the people still have some responsibility. If I offer it all to you and you still don't come, that's not me, the church, that's you, the person. So you still have some responsibility and accountability for yourself to pull yourself up. Now, I'm not absolving the church because I know there are some that's not doing anything for the community. I do understand that. But in those instances where there is some giving and some different things happening, and yet those around haven't taken hold to it, at some point that person is responsible now for their own for where they sit. Would you agree with that?
Well, I mean, I certainly would agree with it, absolutely. There are too many people who go to church with the expectation that the church is there to fix them.
Right.
When in reality, they can only fix themselves.
Right.
However, I approach it from a socioeconomic perspective. And we still have too many churches with all of the problems that are facing African Americans who insist upon putting their resources in buildings. Mm-hmm. Why do we need another Tower of Babel? I mean, here in Dallas, we have any number of mega churches. Mm-hmm. How is that Christ-like? Because Christ, quite frankly, seldom talked about what's going to happen when you get to heaven. He mainly talked about helping you in the here and now, making sure you were fed, making sure you were clothed, and making sure that no one mistreated you merely because of your status. So if there was a leper there, Christ loved that leper. If there was a lady of the evening there, Christ loved that lady of the evening, and he made sure that no one mistreated that person. He didn't hang around with Pontius Pilate and say, hey, Pontius, we got some gays and homosexuals, so let's pass some laws where they can't get married, they can't have a job, they can't have a house, etc. And I don't see, quite frankly, that same love from the church. Let me say this, because I think this is crucial. The number one lesson of Jesus was not faith in a particular religion. It was not obedience to a Bible or a book or a church or a minister. The number one lesson of Christ was love, L-O-V-E. And that's what I don't see in many of these churches.
You know, I have to agree with you, Leo. But, you know, at the same time, it's interesting, and going back to Jima's point, that some of this infrastructure is there. But the question remains, are these people taking advantage of it? You know, I mean, it's almost like the school system. You provide an education, but you're not attending, you're not doing your homework. You know, you're not showing up for class. So going back to the individual responsibility, I think, yes, the church does have some culpability in it. But, you know, it seems to me that we're in a day and age where people are going to their corners and not really trying to do anything else. It's almost like people owe them something. So it's to me, it's also a mindset. Our mindset has changed for some reason. Now, I don't know if it has to do anything with religion or not, but it's definitely a different mindset today than it was back then.
Well, I don't want to interrupt Jima because I value her opinion, but I want to make sure that at least I'm focused on the real purpose of the blog. Yes, God knows I need faith. I need to believe. But my concern is, what is the obligation of the church, of the institution, to helping people in the here and now and in solving some of the problems that we're dealing with? And I just don't believe the church has stepped up to the plate.
Yeah, I think that can be looked at in a couple of different ways, but certainly there's enough evidence to suggest that that it is not doing enough in plight of all of the issues that we're receiving. Jim, you have a comment?
Well, I still think it goes back to the person's responsibility. I mean, there's prime examples of churches that do things in their communities. And yet when it's time to do the work to meet the needs of those who are less fortunate, because Scripture also teaches us to take care of the least of these. It said the poor, the children, the elderly, the widow. Those are the people that we're supposed to really lend a hand to. And when it's time to do that, you know, it talks about there being a lot of work, but we don't have a lot of workers. And so you're in that same situation where the 20% is doing 80% of all the work. And so when it's time to meet the need of the people, you don't have a lot of people there to meet the need because they're nowhere around. They're caught up in their own world. They're caught up in their own whatever issues they may have going on, or they just don't think that's what they're supposed to do. They don't, you know, you have some people in church who don't think the church body supposed to take care of a member whose lights is about to get cut off. You actually have people in the church that believe that when you talk about benevolence and being of help to someone in need, you know, someone who's really having a hard time of it, to help with their rent or get their kids some school clothes or something along those nature. You have people in the church who say they believe in Christ, who say they are followers of the word, who don't believe that's what they're supposed to be doing. That's somebody else to do. And so how then can the church do when it's filled with people that think and believe like that? So it's a hard place to be in, and yet I understand exactly what you're saying in terms of the church has failed people when they needed them most, and they have failed to meet people where they are. We tend to meet people where we think they should be because of what we think they know. But I often say, you know, I try not to base my teaching or training on what I think you know until I've given it to you myself, because I don't know what somebody else taught you, but this is what I'm going to teach you. And I think when we get to the church, we think everybody in there is on the same level, and they're not. Or we think because you've been in church 20 years, you know, you know all the scriptures you need to know, and that's not true. You still have to work on your relationship, and you still have to know that there are things as a organization that we are responsible for, and we're responsible for one another. We're responsible for our community, and as you saw this week, you know, we do a great work in the community during the summer program, but what we know is that need is there all year. That need is there every day after school. That there's a child that goes home hungry every day. And they're not just hungry in the summertime. They just don't need educational assistance during the summertime. They need to be fed after school every day. And we can't do it because we don't have enough people willing to come and do the work. So I agree with you 110% that we have failed. I agree with that. But then when I flip it, I also know that there are some that are trying, and then the people in the community aren't receptive to what they're trying to do. So it's kind of, you know, on both sides of that.
Let me ask you something, though. I mean, I understand what you're saying, Jima, and you referenced me coming to speak to some of your students, which I really enjoyed. Even though I'm not quite sure that I really reach them, you know, I often wonder about that. Am I making sense? Are they hearing what I'm saying? Will it make a difference in their lives? And I guess time will tell. But my question to you, though, Jima, is this. If it is true that the church should be doing more, but it just doesn't have the people who are willing to really go out and do the labor to build a community, why is it that same church can build a church? And it has the resources to build a church, but it doesn't have the resources to build the community that the church is in. I guess my argument is it's because it's a question of will, not ability. They put
Correct.
Their time and resources in what they really want to do, i.e. build the edifice, build the membership, build the business, and don't put that same amount of time and energy in building people.
I agree with you on that. And to reference your first point, you may recall a young man that was laying down when you were there.
Yes.
He said to me that very day that you touched him in such a way. He said, although I was laying down, I heard everything he said. He said, and he was on point, and I really thank you for having him come. That's letting you know that, yeah, they heard you. They were listening, and if you didn't touch nobody else, you touched that young man that day. So the second thing is, I agree with you, that people have a mind to want to go somewhere and look nice, but that's about all they want to do is look nice. They don't want to get their hands dirty to go do the real work. And if you're not willing to go get your hands dirty and do the real work, you're not even going to really build your membership because it's just going to be the same people there. You won't see any growth. So, you know, you might have this big, beautiful building, and you got the same number of people you had when you started. Ain't nobody came. Ain't nobody left because the people that's there, they like how it is. They're not rocking the boat. Ain't nobody challenging them to do nothing. So, but there's no growth. because there comes a time where you should be expanding. When you expand, it's because you need the room, not because you don't have nothing else to do. So I agree with you on that. I think, you know, some people get caught up in what things look like, and they see that part of the vision, but they don't see the part of the vision that's about being able to be a service to someone. If we went from a storefront church to where we are now because we saw a need and we wanted to be a service. And we could even do more if we had more space, but if we also had more people to do the work. So it's, you know, we say we want to do more, but when it's time to do more, you don't have the people there to help you do it.
Yeah, I want to add to that too, though. It's just like any kind of organization or any structure that you have. You're not going to have 100% of the people that are going to participate 100% of the time, nor are you going to have 100% of the people that are going to even be willing to even participate 50% of the time. So the issue becomes that the church is no different. They are made up of people, and people have flaws. And the other thing I want to mention is that just because they attend church don't mean that they are they have the same level of understanding of Jesus' principles. Yeah, just because they go every Sunday. In fact, I remember as a young child in the military traveling all over the country that I used to go to church every Sunday because it was a part of my culture. It was a part of, you know, but I didn't do anything else. I showed up on Sunday because that's what I was supposed to do. I didn't go to Bible study. I didn't go to Sunday school, but I was at Sunday service, and I went out to dinner afterwards because it was a part of my culture. It was a tradition, right? And so not until I got an adult and got older and understanding that this thing in church is more than just a tradition. You just don't go show up on Sundays. You need to be involved. You need to be a little bit more understanding of what's in the Word. You know, it ain't just coming to get a word on Sunday. I should be in studying all the time. I should be praying. So there's a lot of other components to just going to church. But those are the things that we see. So if I go to church and it's full, I'm saying to myself, wow, this church is amazing. But the reality is 80% of those people just come on Sunday and they leave. The other 20% is probably doing everything else, going out in the community, going out, running the church, making sure the finances is okay, doing tithes, doing, you know, offering. Because I've seen it at all levels of the church. Only a few other people are doing majority of the work, even though you got this edifice with all of these people in it. And so I think that problem exists, you know, in industry, in academia, and also in any kind of religious, in any kind of religion you have, that at least in the Christian faith, in my experience has been. And so I think, Leo, that yes, the church has a place in helping the community, but the matter of fact is that the people that are involved in the church are the problem.
I guess one of the concerns I have, though, is this. I think to some extent, though, people of faith apologize for what they know the failings of the church is. You know, it's like me, and if somebody criticizes my family, I'm going to put the defense in the light most favorable to my family member. And that's different from saying what I should say, you know, because I'm biased in favor of my family member. But let me share this experience with you too, though. I mean, I've gone to church a couple of times in the last month, and neither the church fell down nor was I struck by lightning. So I guess that's a good thing, right?
That's
there.
Right.
But what I saw, though, was an institution that was not speaking to the very people that it needs to speak to. And by that I mean the church was dominated by females, and it was dominated by the middle age, even senior citizens. There was indeed a smattering of like 8 and 9 and 10 and 13 and 14-year-old people there. But there was a dearth of African-American males, and there was an absence of young people as a general rule, you know what I mean, family folks. And that lets me know that for whatever reason, the church is either not speaking to people just like me, the very people that you and Jima say the church needs to help do its mission. For some reason, it is not speaking to us, or it is not going after us.
You know, I would say that, and I understand that, but, I mean, you have to speak to your audience at hand, right? I mean, I see a lot of women in the church as well. Well, in our, we're a little different. I mean, the people that are in the church, there are a lot of families in our church. There are a lot of married couples in our church, and I kind of, you know, I really like that part about our church. You know, they're couples. They're not just a lot of single people here and single people there, old people there, young people there. It's kind of balanced. But at the same time, though, is that it's also incumbent upon the man to be at church on a consistent basis, not be at home watching the game, not be at home doing his making excuses, because I've done it too. But at the same time, I try to make an effort to be there, right? When I don't have anything else going on that I think that has to be done, I try to make an effort to be there, because it's important not just for me to be there and get the word, but it's just as important for others to see me there. Right, because when they see a man there, then that gives, that encourages other men to be there. But if we're all at home, you know, because for whatever reason, and we're not, you know, voicing our opinion, participating, teaching Sunday school, teaching Bible study, participating with the kids, then we're not going to be able to get that message, because we're not going to be there. So I think
Mr. Cook, suppose though, and this is where I see the problem. Suppose I, as a male, don't see the value of going to church.
Well, you're just not a member. You have to also look at, you have to look at it as being a partnership, right? If you attend a job, you have some insight or you have some input into that job. You know, if you attend church, you should have some input into what's happening in that church, right? And if it's 100 men and you're the only person that has an issue with a certain issue, then maybe you need to check just that issue. But for the most part, if it's a collective of all the men have the same opinion about an issue, it's not a dictatorship.
But I, as a young male, don't see the value in going to church.
I think that's another issue.
That's my point. I mean, I think you brought up not too long ago, there is a declining membership in many of our houses of worship. There is a whole segment of African-American society that is simply not going to church. They just aren't doing it. And what if the case is the reason they're not going to church is twofold, because they don't see any value to going to church, or the church is not seeking them out?
So when you talk about the value of going to church, to me, or the church not seeking them out, that still has something to do with the person needing to go and find some place that they can find that value in. And if it's not this church, then go find another one until you feel comfortable where you are and you feel a part of that environment. The second thing is, because this young man yesterday, when we went to the nursing home, Troy, he talked about fast food blessings. And we tend to have this mentality of we don't want to wait on nothing. So even in our faith, even in our in our trust in God, we don't want to wait. We want to say to God, I want this new house, and we want to magically the house appear. And we want things to happen just like that. And that's not life. It's never been that way. Nothing's never just happened. You know, the good things that we all enjoy in life took some time to develop. The cars we ride in now wasn't the first model. So but when it comes to our faith and it comes to believing in God, we want it to be instantaneous, the return. But it's not. But in no other part of our lives are we wanting anything to be instant like that. So we've got to really figure out what that's all about. We've got to manage that expectation and realize that might be a tad bit unrealistic. So when you say you don't value the church, is that you don't value the fellowship with other people that believe like you believe. You don't value the camaraderie of being able to sit down with another man or a woman and share, some testimonies of the goodness or even share some trials and how you made it through. You don't value just being able to be at peace in a place that gives you that. What is it that you're not valuing? And then what if the church never comes to you? That doesn't mean you don't go to the church. So sometimes we're not healed from something or not delivered from something or not or don't find something or don't or go without because we don't tell somebody that's what we need. So, you know, if I never tell my husband I need him to tell me he loves me, I know he does, but I need to hear it, then that's not his fault that I'm walking around here half crazy because he ain't told me he loved me today. I have to tell him what I need. And so we have to do the same thing in church. I have to, you know, I tell the people what I need from them. And then if they can't give it to me or fail to, I have to make a decision as to whether or not I'm going to stay somewhere that's not giving me what I need to be all I can be there. It's just like any other relationship.
Yeah, I mean, it's strange that, you know, we go to a steakhouse and we hate the steak and for that particular place, but that don't mean we stop eating steak. We just stop going to that particular restaurant. You know, we move on. We continue to eat. You know, the same thing, you know, with religion. And in fact, when you get sick, you have to go seek out a doctor. The doctors don't come around and make house visits and check on you. You have to go out and check. And so until you go to the house where to ask for your needs to be met, then you begin it begins to take shape for you. And again, finally, going back to the whole issue of personal relationship, as you begin to – if you just go to church just to look for the preacher to do, to give you something, then you're probably in a situation where half the battle is already lost, because you have to really study to show yourself approved. You have to really, you know, get into the Word yourself. You need to go to church prepared. And so a lot of people don't do that. Don't do that extra work and expect the preacher to do it for themselves. And the church is just an edifice, as you mentioned before. And it takes the people to really do the work. And, you know, and the preacher tries, he makes an effort. And the deacons, they make an effort, you know, to try to, and especially these mega churches, it's hard for them to get everybody. But for the most part, they really make an effort. But it's also the same personal responsibility is for our society to make sure that they're attending school and make sure that they're, you know, doing their homework to make sure they're eating right. It's the same personal responsibility with your faith. I mean, the church does have a responsibility. There's a declining attendance, and there may be some people that are not getting their needs met and may not be finding value in it. But it's also a personal responsibility for them to go and to seek it out as well.
Well, what is the personal responsibility of the church, though? I mean, is the personal responsibility of the church merely to save souls, merely to grow the business, merely to build an edifice, or is the responsibility of the church to do more? I mean, we could debate forever personal responsibility and church and why people go and why people don't go, but my... And I can deal with that. I mean, I understand that. I respect you. I respect your opinion. I respect you going to church. But my concern is, what is the responsibility of the church and organized religion to do or help deal with some of the problems that are afflicting our community? That's what I don't see.
Well, I understand. Let me ask you a question. What is your expectation of the church? Maybe that's a better question, because I think that, you know, if you ask 100 people, you're going to probably get 100 different expectations of what the church should be or what the church should do or what the church should provide, right? So, but when you're talking about from your perspective, what is your expectation of the church?
Okay. First, to be Christ-like. Secondly, to not just serve the members of the organization, to not just serve people outside the organization, but to build people. In other words, I am concerned about congregations that put $5 million in buildings when they could put $1 million in a building and then use the other money to start franchises that can employ their people, to build hospitals that could provide medical services to folks, and to really engage in a practical ministry. Jesus' ministry was practical. He was concerned about people in the here and now. He helped them with their needs. And again, some of the churches are so concerned about what's going to get to, how to get to heaven, that they just fail miserably in terms of the here and now. So those are the things I want from the church, to be Christ-like, because love is the message of Christ, to be more concerned about everybody as opposed to the members of their particular organization, and to build people and deal with some of the challenges that we have to deal with rather than just preach at people.
And I certainly think I'm going to say, not say all the churches, but a large portion of the churches are doing just that. And now the question then becomes, at what scale are they doing it? And again, you have different maturity levels of people in the church. So some people will just go on Sundays, as I mentioned earlier. Some people will participate in all the events. Some people will study the Word on their own. But the church does provide, at least the majority of the churches that I know, that I've been familiar and associated with, does provide those things. The question is, at what scale can they provide those things effectively? Jima, comment?
Well, I think it's hard to discuss one piece and without discussing it, you know, putting it all in the same bucket. But I think on the one hand, you have to have a place for people to come and worship. Does it have to be a $5 million place? No, it could be a $1 million place. But if it is a $5 million place, what are you doing in that place? What services are you offering? Do you have after-school care? Do you have daycare provided, you know, for kids in the community? Do you have training going on so people can learn training skills? Do you have GED classes happening so people can come there and acquire that? What are you offering in that $5 million building to the community at large? So I get that. And so the responsibility then becomes for those people that do, if you're offering all that and the community is aware, and then the community needs to come and share and be a part of that, utilize those services, and then be able to give back themselves to the same community, to come back and volunteer at the church at some point, to when they go off and start their own, then they need to reach back and train up another set of people there. So I think if you have such a structure, what are you doing with it? Is it just to have a $5 million, just to say you built a $5 million building? Or are you doing something while you're there with that $5 million building? And so it has to balance itself out. And if you're not doing anything, then, yeah, I have a problem with you just having this nice building, but it's only open on Sunday and Wednesday. Because people, you know, don't just need church on Sunday and Wednesday or whatever day you're there for choir rehearsal. You know, hospitals is open all the time. And if I'm spiritually in need, I need to be able to find that place close to me and go and be there. But I can't do that if the building is only open on 2 days out the week. So I get that, you know. So I think it has to be an and. This is another thing. It's not an or. I think it's an and. What you know, how do we incorporate those other uplifting, building, training things to help people be able to help themselves? How do we do that in the body of Christ?
Outstanding. Leo, last, give you the final comments.
Well, despite, again, some of my concerns and hesitations, I know that I am uniquely blessed by God and that I am obligated, morally obligated, to make the world a better place. And so despite some of my comments that I've made, I have a ministry that God wants me to do, and I'm going to do it. And I'm just struggling with what's the best way to do that.
Do you want to share it, or are you just still struggling with how you're going to put it together?
I've pretty much figured how I'm going to put it together. I mean, I think Black Acre is crucial to that. But I'm still struggling with my destiny, trying to figure out what God really wants me to do, and trying to find the best connection that I can have to the divine, because I do agree that it is a personal relationship. I'm just not persuaded that it is a typical church situation, if you understand what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just not convinced of that. I'm just not convinced that my role should be to go to church every Sunday and to do the typical church thing.
Mm-hmm. So again, I think as you study the word, as you begin to establish a relationship with God, then some of those things will work itself out, right? Whether it's not going to be my opinion of where you go every Sunday or not. It's not going to be, the person, your neighbor or your best friend. You're going to be able to understand what God provides of you. You're going to be understand where you need to be. So it's not going to be somebody forcing you to be anything. You're going to resolve for yourself what's the best way for you to resolve this on your own. So you'll get there. And it won't be no question in your mind, whether you're doing the right thing or not. Because God has a way of showing you better than he's going to show me on what's right for you. I guarantee you that.
I agree with that.
All right, Lee,
that wraps
up our segment. I just want to say, man, it's always a pleasure to have this segment on the show. This is just awesome. Great dialogue. I think within the weeks to come, we're going to start getting more people, more callers over here. We're getting a lot of good attention already. We're going to ramp up the efforts. You're going to start hearing, we're going to have to really block out some time to give people some time to call in and ask questions, because I think it's going to be picking up here pretty soon.
Hey, thank you. And Jima, thanks for inviting me to your church to talk to the young people there. I really appreciate it.
You are more than welcome. It won't be your last time.
No, it won't.
Awesome. All right. Thanks a lot, Leo.
Hey, thanks, sir.
It's time for Black Acre Policy Forum, a progressive think tank founded by Leo Baron Hicks. A place where a new dialogue concerning public policy can find innovative strategies and bold solutions. Welcome to Black Acre Policy Forum.
I'm able to see clear the right, cause Louis H. Lattimore improved the light, and J.A. Burr invented the lawnmower. Let me expand the mind of all you young soldiers. Sarah Boone invented the eye.
Yeah, that was certainly a great segment, Jima. We're getting ready to wrap up here. Before we go, I wanted to talk a little bit about Paul George and the fact of his injury. What do you think about what impact is it going to have on his ball club?
Oh, it's major, because Paul George is like the nucleus of that team. I mean, that's just like LeBron going down where he is now, Cleveland, or Tom Brady not playing for the Patriots. I mean, it's major. So I my prayer is that, he heals, but he gives himself the time to heal. And that's a major blow. That's a major blow to the NBA because of it's the USA team, and it's they have these exhibition games coming up, and so it's gonna have an impact on those players that's gonna want to play in those exhibition games in the future.
Yeah. Now, the doctor that had Ebola in Africa arrived in Atlanta and Georgia not too long ago. What do you think about bringing him back to the United States with that disease?
Well, I think, this is his home. I think they should have brought him back to get the treatment here that he needs. I'm sure he'll get the best services, the best treatment, and maybe if they do it right, they'll be able to take whatever over to those other countries that are being infected by it. So I think it was a good deal. I mean, it's kind of like a soldier, you never leave no one behind. And so, we shouldn't have left him over there, and I'm glad we brought him back.
All right, final thoughts?
Final thoughts, I ended, our summer program ended on last Friday, August 1st. It was a long 7-week program. I think we did what we set out to do every year, which is to feed the children, but also to educate them, to try to teach them some skills around conflict resolution and some social skills and things of that nature. And I think we did that. So we'll see what next year holds. If it holds anything, we'll see. And but I am ready for a much-needed break. August is a busy month for me, my family, with birthdays and things of that nature. So I'm looking forward to not having to get up in the morning and just enjoying a day off. And then I only get one day because I've got to get ready for all these other events that's coming up.
All right, that's our show for today. Now, of course, I'd like to thank my co-host, the wonderful, the magnificent Jima Hill Cook. Now, you can follow her on Twitter, and that's at Ask Jima. That's AskJEMA. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small businesses and nonprofits. Now, don't forget to bookmark this site and visit my blog. And that's at TaylorMadeTalkRadio.blogspot.com. That's TaylorMade. Talk Radio, all one word. blogspot.com. Until next time, remember it is written, my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. So stay engaged, stay informed, and stay plugged in to Current Events with Patrick Cook. You're listening to the sounds of Joyce Spencer in Sweet Dreams. Take us away, Joyce.